Well, with us in studio this afternoon is the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Jack Chambers. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rachel.
As we've been saying, the EU has just published more than 200 pages of goods which could attract extra tariffs. At what point would these measures be introduced?
So the first point is, I think it's helpful that Ursula von der Leyen and indeed Maroš Šefčovič have set out that this is a consultation to engage with industry and the wider economy and member states on the list of countermeasures which have been outlined. And the focus is still on a deal, on trying to get a negotiated solution. How can the EU and the US achieve frictionless and beneficial trade between both respective trading blocks? And that's the basis upon which this has been established. This is solely preparatory in the context of negotiations which are happening in parallel. But the EU must prepare itself for all eventualities. And it's in that spirit that this is being outlined whilst the negotiations continue. And that's the central focus of Maroš Šefčovič, who's negotiating on behalf of the EU, and that we have a common sense solution that benefits both nations. We know the impact of this already. We know that the current tariffs are raising costs, they're stifling growth, and they're fueling inflation, and they're heightening uncertainty when it comes to investment and the prospects of economic growth within the EU, but also in the US itself. So the emphasis here has to be on trying to get a deal. From an Irish perspective, we'll fully assess the respective countermeasures which have been published, and obviously engage with the wider economy and industry on the specific sectoral impacts which
be asking Ryanair about the aircraft's part of this?
We'll engage with all sectors of the economy and get their feedback on these specific countermeasures. But when countermeasures are published, and if there was an escalation, you know, Ireland and every other EU member state will not be immune to the significant impacts of that. And we know that Ireland is an open trading economy, very much diversified across the board. This will have a multiplicity of impacts across many sectors. And that's part of the risk that any escalation will represent, both for the EU and indeed the US. And then separately, there's obviously ongoing work within the EU on monitoring the diversion of global exports in the context of third countries and protecting the integrity of the EU market in that sense. But I think I welcome the focus of this statement from the European Commission. It is about trying to establish a trade deal, trying to focus that engagement in the context of the EU and the US.
Right.
And that's the emphasis from the Irish government.
And that's all well and good, but why do you think the UK is making more progress than the EU? Because as we've been hearing, they already have a deal.
Well, we have to see what the outworkings of that is and what it actually represents for the UK economy net of where they were a few weeks ago before tariffs were
imposed. Are you a bit sceptical then about what might actually be in there?
I think we heard from George Parker there about what was agreed and what it actually represents. And obviously we'll have to hear from the British government on that. But I think establishing a negotiation and finalising a deal has to be the central focus to preserve international trade, to try and create prosperity for the future. And we know the impact, the positive impact that has had on Ireland and indeed EU citizens across the board over the last number of years, and trying to re-emphasise the need for a rules-based international order when
it
comes to trade.
Isn't that one of the problems, though, that Donald Trump thinks it's been too positive for the EU and he wants some of the investment back for America?
Well, I think there's been mutual benefits, and we know how the broader economic conditions changed for the US before their pause, which they introduced. But we know this is a roller coaster that will continue now over the next number of weeks. It's wise that the EU is preparing the possible countermeasures. But I think the focus and the emphasis from all aspects of the European position is on trying to have a frictionless, you know, zero for zero trade deal, has been mentioned by President von der Leyen, and that will represent more opportunities if that can be agreed with the US administration.
And will that be possible in the short term? Because your cabinet colleague Peter Burke told the BBC this morning that it would be very challenging for the EU to get a trade agreement before the July deadline.
It's going to be challenging, but that's the focus. And we have to see how the US and indeed the EU's position evolves in the days prior to that. And I suppose there is obviously general uncertainty about what the aftermath of that July window will be. And we know that an escalation is a downside for both the EU and indeed the US. And it's a lose-lose position with significant downside risks for the Irish economy if there isn't a negotiated outcome.
Under the post-Brexit arrangements, the North is supposed to apply EU customs rules on imports. So could there be trouble ahead?
Well, there is a process there, and in fairness, good cooperation between the British government and the European Union when it comes to all aspects of the Windsor framework. We'll obviously assess, or the EU will assess, the whatever is agreed between the UK and the US and how that outworking of that in respect of the Windsor framework and that spirit.
Is there a possibility, though, that there could be more friction there and that you might have some people wanting to reopen the Windsor framework?
Well, we'll have to assess the impact of what has been agreed and how it interacts with the Windsor framework, and central to that will be preserving the integrity of the EU single market and indeed the trade competence within the EU. But there are ground rules about how that operates in the context of international trade deals that the UK can progress, obviously in the aftermath of Brexit, the outworking of the UK-US deal will be the general assessment of that in what is set out in the Windsor framework.
But it is something you're actively looking at the moment.
Well, we'll obviously have to assess it from a North-South perspective, and we'll engage with the EU in the context of the agreed rules that are set out in the Windsor framework and the and how that affects all matters relating to North-South dimension, but also East-West as well. And I think there's good cooperation on all sides to engage on that basis.
Separately, you're publishing new guidelines this afternoon on the use of artificial intelligence in the public service. We heard about it there in our news bulletin. How widespread is the use of AI in the public service at the moment?
It's patchy and it's being used in different parts, and I think we've seen positive examples how it can be used. So we know, for example, the huge opportunities that it represents in terms of healthcare transformation. It's being piloted, for example, in St. Vincent's University Hospital when it comes to some of the cardiac interventions and diagnosis. It's being used by the revenue commissioners around certain data processing. It's been used by the CSO. So it has been used in parts, but what I'm trying to encourage is, and I suppose empower public servants and indeed those who are designing the future of the public service, to actually positively adopt AI as a force for good. But we need to have a framework around that so that we build public trust about how it's being used, that it's used responsibly, that data is managed properly and that it's used to actually drive better efficiencies as well and value for money considerations.
You don't want public servants to use free AI tools like ChatGPT. So what can workers use?
So we'll be adopting essentially AI solutions in the context of, say, processes or systems that are currently in the public service. So, for example, the OECD has published good use of AI in the context, say, grant applications, for example. There's possibilities on driving efficiency there when you may have a significant number of public servants in processing thousands of applications. We can create administrative efficiencies there whilst people be continuing to have, obviously, human oversight is important.
But you can't just go on to ChatGPT or whatever and ask it to try and solve your problems for you.
We have to be very careful not to input data or people's individual information into free AI models that you've referenced, and we've received security advice in that context. So this is to empower the appropriate use of AI, to encourage its use and deployment across agencies in the public service. It represents great opportunity, as I said, in healthcare, where it can be used, I think, to transform. AI has opportunities to transform outcomes for patients.
Is it likely, though, that ultimately it will lead to a need for fewer workers?
Well, I think it's more about how workers are deployed in the public service, and in fact, workers will be and have to be involved in the broader chain of command when it comes to the appropriate adoption of AI. So, if AI is allowed to be deployed without oversight and without people involved and proper accountability, then that presents excessive risk. So I think it's about AI empowering workers to actually deliver a better public service, and for that to be done in a balanced way that manages the risks that are involved. But we want to, it's important to have a framework to allow for its adoption, for public servants to engage in the solutions that it represents in the work that they do, and that helps deliver a better service for citizens across Ireland. And that's why when we're trying to advance AI adoption, for example, in the private sector, we need to make sure that the public service is also leading in its adoption across the board, and this provides a framework to do that.
Minister Jack Chambers, thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Rachel.